You're listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine. Wow, that was a very, very powerful statement from Syria. Just bordering Syria is the only democracy in the Middle East. Syria is trying to be a democracy. There is a democracy that presently exists. It's, of course, the nation of Israel. Israel is often criticized for its actions toward the Palestinian Arabs on the West Bank. And there's a lot of disagreement, frankly, about exactly what Israel does. I had as a guest just a couple of days ago in a pre-recorded interview, Peter Beinart. He's the author of The Crisis of Zionism. Now, Peter is a traditional Jew. He is Orthodox. He used to work for the New Republic. He and I had quite a disagreement, because he is quite harsh on the current Israeli government, where it's my view that it's a little more nuanced than that. The nice thing about arguing with Peter was that we didn't have to argue over the facts. We both recognize what the facts are. Well, maybe a little bit of argument. Most of it was on the answer. I think he's wrong to put so much blame on the Israeli government. In my view, the Palestinian Arabs could have a state tomorrow if they'd just be willing to compromise and negotiate a little bit. And the heart of our discussion, because Peter Beinart argues in his book that Israel's a democracy, but the West Bank and so forth is not a democracy. And he doesn't mention in his book that 98% of the Palestinian Arabs are under the civil government of the Palestinian Authority, something I bring up to him. Now, he points out it's not all there, and they don't have all the power they do. You can hear our debate in just a minute. But the part that I really think is important to point out, the part that nobody talks about whenever people talk about Israel and the West Bank, is that most of the conflict is over empty land. Almost 60%, definitely more than half, of the West Bank is empty land where neither Jews nor Arabs live. And the Palestinians say, we won't accept a state of our own where we rule ourselves if we don't get all this empty land too. And Israel says, we'll give you most of it, but we can't give you all of it. That's what the fight's about. I don't think it's about democracy like in Syria where people are fighting and dying. I think it's about everyone wants all the land. And I actually think that there's much more room for compromise in Israel. Here, let me go right to my debate with Peter Beinart.
One of the things in which I take great pride as a Zionist and as a supporter of the State of Israel is that inside its original boundaries, Israel offers citizenship to all people, irrespective of ethnicity, and Arab citizens of Israel serve in the Knesset and the Supreme Court. They are discriminated against, but in many ways they have more rights than do Palestinians and Arabs in much of the Middle East. But in 1967, Israel occupied the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and there, in the West Bank, only Jews have citizenship, only Jews have the right to vote, only Jews live under civil law. Palestinians have radical restrictions on their right to movement. They carry cards of a different color. They go before military courts. They're not citizens. They don't have the right to vote. And I believe that's what I mean, what I call non-democratic Israel, in contrast to democratic Israel.
Well, here's the thing that I find in your book that a lot of people who make the argument you make don't include, and that is the statistics of what actually is in the West Bank legally as a result of the Oslo Accords. Here's the part that I think most people don't know. If you drive through the West Bank, as I know you have, as I have, you see lots and lots of hilltops, lots of desert where nobody lives. 40% is under Palestinian control. And in that 40%, more than 95% of the Arabs live. The Jews are on about 2% of the West Bank, which is, of course, controlled by Israel. And then the remaining 58% or so is controlled by Israel, but nobody lives there. And it seems to me that the part that I think would make your book a little more fair is if you pointed out that the arguments between the Israelis and the Palestinian Authority is about empty land.
But, first of all, I think it's important to acknowledge that even in areas A and B, area which A, which is under Palestinian security and civil control, and area B, another 20%, which is under Palestinian civil control but not military control, that Israel has the right and takes advantage of the opportunity of sending its military into all of that territory, 100% of the West Bank. No part of the West Bank, that the 20% which is under full Palestinian control is not contiguous. You're right that the vast majority of the Palestinian population in the West Bank lives under Palestinian civil control. But the question of control of land is absolutely essential. The land includes water, which is very, very significant for the growth of communities. It's also the land which allows communities to grow. And while it's true that the settlement, the built-up part of the settlements, only represent a very small percentage of the West Bank, the municipal area of the settlements, which is to say the land that Israel has taken for the growth of settlements, is about 40%. And as you yourself acknowledge, Area C, which is under Israeli control, is 60%. So what that means is the Palestinian towns and villages have very, very little access to grow. Growth is absolutely essential for economic development. That's what I think is part of what makes Palestinian life in the West Bank so difficult.
Let's go through each of the things you said there. When you talk about Israel can go in, you would concede that that doesn't happen very often, that usually it's only when there's a terrorist attack and Israel is practicing, you know, right of pursuit, where they go after someone who's just done some violent attack and go out and get them, when the Palestinian Authority is not going to get them themselves. When's the last time that Israel went into...
I actually was just happened to be talking to a woman from Ramallah who said that she sees raids, she says Israeli troops going into Ramallah very, very frequently. I don't have the data in front of me. I think that Israel, you're right that Israel would prefer the Palestinian Authority to do that, but in terms of the question of, you know, whether Palestinians in Area A, again, which is only 20% of the West Bank, enjoy, and again, it's the disconnected area of different towns and villages with areas B and C in between it, whether they have real sovereignty, the fact that Israel has the right to go in, I think just really suggests that this is an area which is still fundamentally under Israeli control. The Israelis might prefer the Palestinian Authority do it, but if the Palestinian Authority won't do it, then the IDF will do it.
Now, do you think that if a Palestinian comes from Area A and goes into a Jewish settlement and murders someone in the Jewish settlement and runs back to Area A and is not turned over by the Palestinian Authority, do you think that person basically gets a pass, they can kill someone and get home free? Or do you think that if the Palestinian Authority won't turn that killer over, that Israel has a right to go in and get them?
I don't think that's not the point that I'm making. The point that I'm that the point is not that I want Palestinian terrorists to go free. Certainly not at all. The question I think we were discussing is, what are the terms under which Palestinians live in the West Bank? One might justify that they have to remain under Israeli control for Israeli security. I wouldn't, but someone could make that argument. But even that therefore acknowledges that they are under Israeli control.
Well, let me ask you this.
Israel controls the borders, you know, in and out of the West Bank. Go ahead.
You could see that 95% plus. The latest one I saw showed 98%, but we can argue whether it's 95 or 98%. But the vast majority of Arabs living in the West Bank live under the Palestinian Civil Authority. And this Palestinian Civil Authority is corrupt. It hasn't had elections in years. But I take it you don't blame Israel for the fact that the democratic choices of the Arabs with regard to the Palestinian Authority are not great. I mean, that's clearly not Israel's fault, is it?
Well, first of all, can I just ask you, it's interesting to me that you keep using the term Arabs. Do you
right.
not recognize that there are a group of people who call themselves Palestinians?
Well, I don't believe that Arabs get to call themselves Palestinians uniquely. I don't understand why this term. If you study pre-state Zionism, you know that Palestine was the term used by the Jews. There was the Palestine Post, which is now the Jerusalem Post.
Yes, that's true. And, you know, in 1900, there were also no people who called themselves Nigerians or Indonesians or Ghanaians or Kenyans.
Right,
this
right.
is the history of much of the developing world, that national identities emerged that people embraced.
Right,
in
but
the
it's a new
that's
identity.
What
it's created
too. I think we should call people what they call themselves.
Well, I think if the problem with that is that if we suggest that the Arabs of the West Bank are Palestinians and therefore have the right to all of Palestine, then you assume the question.
I didn't say they have the right to all Holocaust.
Yeah, but that's what happens when you give them the name, see. It's all, I mean, there's a reason, you know, of course, that Arab nationalism, I mean, in the 1960s.
Go ahead.
But I was just going to say, I mean, they did not consider themselves Palestinians until very recently. They considered themselves Arabs. Back when Egypt and Syria were one country in the 1960s, they insisted that there's one Arab nation, that you can't split it up. I realize that they call themselves Palestinians now, and I do refer to the Palestinian Authority. But it seems to me that are the Jews who live there not also Palestinians?
Well, Jews tend to call ourselves Jews. That's been the kind of the consensus decision made
for thousands of years.
We consider ourselves, and I consider us, to have a deep, deep historic connection,
right,
biblical connection to the West Bank.
Right.
But I think as a matter of fundamental respect, if you want peace and justice between peoples, you start by calling people the term they call themselves. And I think your decision not to do that essentially will make a conversation, a dignified and respectful conversation between you and Palestinians, and I assume you must have lots of them on your show since you're interested in this subject.
I have had several.
Would make that very difficult.
Well, I'm okay with calling them Palestinian.
Palestinians on the show?
I'm afraid with calling them Palestinian Arabs. And yes, I've had a number of Palestinian Arabs on the show.
So then you call them Palestinian Arabs?
I'm fine with that, or Arabs who live in Palestine. The problem is when you assume that Palestine...
I would certainly be unhappy if someone decided that I should be called other than something that I call myself, and I would think that we would want to accord other people the same dignity, regardless of when that term became current, because there are many, many terms that people call themselves all over the world that are relatively recent provenance. To get back to your question about the elections, There are a number of reasons that the Palestinian Authority has not held elections. Partly it's because Fatah is corrupt, and Fatah doesn't want to take the risk that they will lose elections. But I think it's also the case that Israel and the United States have a fundamental problem, which is that we don't want to risk elections that Hamas might win. And I think there's a fundamental contradiction there. If you support democracy and free elections, you have to take the risk that people who you don't like might win those elections.
But you're not arguing that the reason why Fatah has not had elections has to do with Israeli pressure not to have elections. I mean,
well, I think it's certainly, I think the fact that the Palestinians have not created a unity government, a unity government that I think could lay the groundwork for new elections, is partly because Fatah and Hamas hate each other and there's a lot of blood between the two of them. But also, I think absolutely because it's a very strongly held position of the Israelis and to some degree of the U.S., then, in fact, we don't want a unity government.
But here's the thing. When you say that the Arabs that live in the West Bank, the Palestinians, as you call them, as they call themselves, who live in 95% of them, or more, actually, it's closer to 98%, can vote or can choose their authority, are under the Palestinian civil authority. You call this non-democratic Israel because you presume that they should be able to vote in Israeli elections.
No. I presume I don't want them to vote in Israeli elections.
Okay.
I want them to be a Palestinian state, but they're not citizens of the state.
Right.
You're right. In 20% of the West Bank, there is Palestinian civil authority, so the Palestinian Authority is making decisions about education and roads and these kind of things. But this is not citizenship in a state. It is Israel that controls access in and out of the West Bank. It is Israel that makes it controls decisions about the currency. Israel can send its troops into has the right to send its troops into every single corner of the West Bank. None of us would, and Israel makes decisions that have dramatic impacts on Palestinian movement. So none of us, if we were living under such a circumstance, even if would consider that sovereignty.
Except that, of course, Israel makes throughout Israel, as you know, Jews have to go through checkpoints all the time. In fact, if you go in Israel, in fact, it's just interesting. The Jewish areas tend to have barbed wires to keep out terrorists. The Arab Israelis don't think
that's right. There have been terrible, terrible acts of Palestinian terrorism, which I call in my book grotesque and unforgivable. One of them took the life of a friend of mine. But But there have also been, as I'm sure you know, there have been a significant number of attacks by Jewish settlers on Palestinians in the West Bank. That's been another kind of
there have been a few, and they're terrible.
That Palestinians absolutely suffer from.
Right, and absolutely, and those people have been and should be punished severely, as they are.
Some have been punished severely. The vast, vast majority of bringing of cases of, against Jewish settlers who conduct violence in the West Bank, and it's extraordinarily low.
I remember just recently when they had the attacks on, I think it was a mosque, and they called it the price tag attacks. And the Israeli government, all the way up to its highest levels, was seeking out to find those people and to punish them. And
that's one anecdote.
Well, of course, you say the number of reported attacks, it all goes with who's doing the reporting and where it's coming from.
The attacks by Arabs against Jews are far, far greater in number than any attacks by Jewish settlers on Arabs. And, of course, Israel is committed to putting those people in jail, whereas the Palestinians often let the attackers go free.
One of the things that I noticed in your book is that whenever I read anecdotes in your book, I would go and immediately Google and find out, for example, in the case, the very very poignant case you talk about early on in your book, you leave out some salient facts.
That's actually not. I mean,
that a Palestinian man attacked the police.
This was reported by in Haaretz and other Israeli point that I'm trying to make is that as non-citizens in the West Bank, who are relatively powerless over the government that controls much of their lives, because even it's still the government of Israel, that they are profoundly disadvantaged, and that plays itself out in very, very painful ways.
Well, as you say, I mean, 95-98% live under Palestinian civil authority.
Do you agree with me that civil authority is a far, far cry from sovereignty, don't you?
Well,
in regards to things like travel in and out of the West Bank.
Well, there are restrictions for everybody. There are checkpoints for everybody. But you're absolutely right that Area C includes roads that go through Area A and Area B, and you also know that Israel has offered to give up the vast majority of Area C. The Arabs of the West Bank refuse to take this empty land, the vast majority of which has been given to them.
Israel has offered the Palestinians a state again and again and again and again and again, repeatedly. Have a state, have a state, have a state. And the Palestinians repeatedly say, no, we won't take a state unless it's on our terms. We don't just want where all the Arabs in the West Bank live, on the half of the West Bank, 40% of the West Bank where they all live. We want all the rest of it too, every single inch of it. And we won't even take 90%, say, of what we want. And my question is why they keep rejecting this quite generous offer.
Okay, well, all right, so let's talk about that, because I go into it in my book.
Yes, you do.
Ehud Barak offered a trade to Palestinians in 91% of the West Bank with a 1% land swap from within Green Line Israel and a Palestinian capital in some but not all of the Palestinian, and a 12-year Israeli control of the Jordan Valley.
That was the original offer. They described an offer of 95%.
But let's be clear here what we're talking about here. 91%, 95%, some would say 97%. This is empty land. This is empty land. You cannot say that it's not democratic when Israel is offering a complete state to wherever the Arabs live. 98% of the Arabs live, and they get to control their entire destiny in a contiguous state. That they get. And they get, another 80-90% of the empty land. That's what they refused. So it's not like Israel hasn't offered the Palestinians a state on some very, very favorable terms to the Palestinians.
But we can dispute. We can,
I've read a great deal of the literature on Camp David. There's a lot of ambiguity about Barak's offer because it was not written up, and it was essentially verbally expressed through the Americans. But I've never seen a figure that describes it as 95%. If one's talking about the area between the Green Line and the border with Jordan, maybe if one excludes Jerusalem, maybe you could get to 95%.
I'll send you the map. But it's clearly more than 90%.
There's no question that the Palestinians simply say Israel offered to give them virtually everything and they turned it down. There are Israeli negotiators like Gilad Shar who say that Arafat counter offered with a proposal of a 2-3% equal land swap in the West Bank and control of all the Palestinian neighborhoods of East Jerusalem, and international force in the Jordan Valley. So there was a difference of opinion here.
Just to be clear, as
a terrible, terrible leader of his people, and I call his role in the Second Intifada a crime. But there was also the fundamental problem that precisely because of settlements, it was very difficult for Israel to get down to a 2-3% land swap because they felt like they needed to incorporate so much more land in order to keep large settlements that Israel had built.
Just to make the historic record clear, as you know, the Americans, President Bill Clinton, who gave a nice blurb for your book, and Dennis Ross, are firmly of the opinion that it was entirely the Palestinians' fault. They lay the full onus of the failure of Camp David
at their feet. There were a lot of different Americans at Camp David. That's not the view of Martin Indyk and Aaron Miller and Rob Malley, who were three of the negotiators who were there, all of whom I'm not trying to excuse the Palestinians for blame whatsoever, but there was a fundamental problem for Mies the way they needed to on right of return. And I say in my book very clearly that we don't know. There are reasons to believe they may not have, even though there is Israeli negotiators who believe that they were willing to prepare to accept a relatively symbolic right of return if they got.
Peter, not everybody knows what the right of return is. So let me just explain what that is.
Even at Taba, the Israelis were still up at an 8% annexation, which was above the Clinton parameters. It becomes hard to be within the Clinton parameters.
Peter, just to be clear, what the right of return means, because not everyone knows what that term means.
Sure.
That, of course, is the right of anyone whose great-great-grandfather once lived in Palestine. 7 million people make that claim to come in and basically come into Israel proper and end the Jewish state as we know it. So the heart of the Palestinians did not agree not to end the Jewish state as we know it. That seems to me to be a non-starter in negotiations.
Look, to be very clear, I am not in favor of a large-scale return of Palestinian refugees and their descendants that would threaten the demographic character of the State of Israel. But one can't simply wave it away. I think that the question is, if Palestinians get a viable contiguous state on 95%+, and I think combined with a statement of historical acknowledgement of the suffering of the Palestinians, I think would be the right response to this very difficult problem.
And listen, I would have no problem with a statement of the historical suffering. I would have no problem with a few thousand coming in. But of course, it's not up to you or to me to make these decisions, and I guess that's where it comes down to my real problem with your book.
But let me just say that Abbas acknowledged a refugee return not threaten Israel's demographic character. As I said, Yossi Beilin and Gilad Shar both believed that the Palestinian negotiators at Camp David and Taba were willing to accept a relatively small-scale right of return. So the Palestinian record on right of return,
I well know that the Palestinian Authority, Abbas and Arafat used to do this as well, would say one thing in English, and what you're doing is you're taking all these strands, you're ignoring the fact that Bill Clinton and Dennis Ross said Arafat had a Palestinian state on the table and he refused it, and you're just taking the strands that you want to hear.
No, that's not true. What I'm doing is I explicitly acknowledge both strands and say...
But the book doesn't mention the other
here,
side.
And parenthetically, you know, if you look at the question of Israeli leaders and what they say, right? We had an Israeli cabinet minister, Benny Begin, last week come out say very explicitly the policy of this Israeli government is not for two states. Moshe Yaalon, the vice prime minister, said last year this government is trying to bury the two-state solution. Israeli governments also talk out of both sides of their mouths. The question is, how do we act in such a way that increases the likelihood that the Palestinians will make the wrenching compromises that they need to make? That's the key question for me.
But Peter, your book... You don't mention both sides. You don't say that Bill Clinton said that it is entirely Arafat's fault that there's no Palestinian state. You don't say that Dennis Ross, the lead American negotiator, says the only reason there's no Palestinian state is because Arafat would not even give a counter offer. You don't mention the map from the Orient House, from the Palestinians themselves, that shows very clearly that Israel offered more than 95% of the West Bank. Instead, you take a few comments here, a few comments comments there, and you put only those in your book if you had both sides in your book, right? Rather, if you mention what Bill Clinton said and also what some peace negotiator says, you say they say, and you know, we can check your sources. Cause the ones I've checked don't show it as clearly as you do. That would be a more fair and balanced book.
And you spend a lot of time in the book attacking, of course, Prime Minister Netanyahu. Or is a democracy Netanyahu is not so much a cause of the problems as an effect of the problems.
Because when Israel withdrew from Gaza, and when Israel said, you know what, we're going to give the Palestinians a chance, we're going to withdraw entirely, 100% from their territory, we're going to build them a seaport, we're going to build them an airport, we're going to allow them complete freedom in Gaza, what did they do? They rained missiles on the Israeli population. And that hardens the Israeli population, that makes them more likely to support people like Netanyahu, and you can't blame them. You give somebody your hand in peace, they slap it down in war. And people respond accordingly. So Netanyahu is not the cause of any of this. He's the effect. When you give in, when you give someone, you know, peace, and they give you war.
And rained rockets into Israeli towns. The Israeli populace made a dramatic rightward shift. And so the Peace Now and other groups that I think you might associate yourself with represent maybe 5% or less of the Israeli Jewish population. Not because these ideas didn't have, support in Israel. They did 10, 12 years ago. But in response to that,
You were right. The Israeli population the Israeli Jewish population has moved to the right in response, I think, particularly to the Second Intifada and to some degree because of what's happened in Gaza. I think demographic shift is also important. The million Russians who lean right, I think, have shifted to some degree the Israeli political balance. And you can see that if you look at Israel. But just because a population of, just because Israeli Jews have a particular narrative of what happened does not mean I need to agree with it any more
than
a Republican in the United States because the Americans turned away from the Republicans and thought they would vote for. They're not shared by, the Palestinians have a very different narrative of what happened in Oslo, in Second Intifada and Gaza. I don't share that, nor do I share entirely the view on the Israeli right of what happened in the Second Intifada and Gaza. I think there were mistakes on both sides which led, and in fact the Mitchell Commission report on the Second Intifada says, blames Arafat for the violence. I call it a crime, his role in the violence, but the Israeli overreaction to the stone throwing,
the first Intifada,
was caused by in response to Ariel Sharon's visit to the Temple Mount, was also a contributor to this terrible
involved guns.
It started
violence.
With stone throwing and escalated into these horrific suicide bombs.
But to me, the issue I want to, and I think you'll agree with me here. And of course, Peter, you have absolutely the right to your own opinion and to express it, and you have, and I'm glad you're coming on my show and expressing it here. But my point about Netanyahu is that Netanyahu is not so much a cause of the problems as an effect of the problems. You have a whole chapter where you blame Netanyahu for the current events in Israel. And I like to argue, and I think you might even maybe agree with me here, that Netanyahu is not a cause so much as an effect. He exists and he's in power because the Israeli populace does not believe the Palestinian Authority seriously wants peace.
Tzipi Livni's Kadima got one more seat, but because there were other right-wing parties that got more seats, Netanyahu was able to form a right-wing coalition. So the evidence
election,
I think, is somewhat more ambiguous. It was a fairly split Israeli population, not between Meretz and Likud. You're right. The more dovish left parties did terribly,
right.
But Kadima, which represent, you know, Olmert had after all. Made an offer that was actually more generous than what Barak had made at Camp David.
Okay.
But then he still got, you know, was still the single biggest party.
But you're not supporting Kadima. You're not supporting the things that are within the mainstream of Israeli thought. You're not even supporting things that are in the mainstream of the left of Israel. You're supporting a view that is the far, far left in Israel and a view that dramatically lost the elections because the Israeli people understand that, unfortunately, there's no one for them to make peace with. And when they do try to make peace and they leave vast areas of territory, those areas of territory are used for suicide bombings, for rockets, and the like. So you know, whether the difference between Kadima and Likud is not near as large as the difference between the vast majority of the Israeli electoral populace and yourself.
I think that the Netanyahu did benefit from the move of Israeli politics to the right. There's no question about that. But to include Livni in his government, which would have had, and therefore given his coalition a more centrist cast, I think is basically hostile to a Palestinian state along the line of the Clinton parameters. And I think that's, in contrast to Olmert, I think that's really unfortunate, because I think negotiations towards that kind of Palestinian state would be good for Israel.
Here's the heart of what I'm suggesting. I think Israel public opinion can change, and if it changes, Netanyahu's out of there. It seems to me, though, that your focus should be on, frankly, on Mahmoud Abbas. If Mahmoud Abbas, and he just wrote a letter, as you know, to Benjamin Netanyahu, say, hey, you know what, the Western Wall is behind the 67 lines, but we recognize that the Jews will be able to pray at the Western Wall. If he were to say, look, I recognize that there's going to be some, we're not going to get 100% of what we want. If he were to say that, that would turn things around dramatically. Either Netanyahu would agree, or if he didn't, he'd be knocked out of the government, because the majority Israeli people, he goes to the United Nations, and in doing so, I think he neglects his own people.
Well, again, the majority of the Israeli people would support a peace settlement with a reliable negotiator who is willing to keep the peace. They've shown that again and again and again. That's why they voted for Barak. That's why they voted for Olmert. That's why the negotiators went as far as they did. But Abbas won't go to the Israeli people. He won't show his bona fides. He won't tell the Israeli people what you claim he tells someone who told someone else in private who said something on some blog. He doesn't do what Sadat did, come to Jerusalem and declare peace. He doesn't say we're willing to accept less than 100%. He won't say that we are willing to give up the right of return, to give up our claim to destroy the Jewish state of Israel by bringing 7 million people in. If he would just reach out a little bit to the Israeli people, instead of going to the United Nations, instead of going to the United States, he needs to understand who he's making peace with. He's not making peace with the United States. He's not making peace with the United Nations. All he has to do is go to the Israeli people, and they would, either Netanyahu would have to listen, or they would vote Netanyahu out. But Abbas, by going to these international sources that are extremely anti-Israel, ensures there will never be a Palestinian state as long as he is running the Palestinian Authority.
Well, I think that I think when you say that Israelis want a two-state solution,
I'd say two-thirds do.
Right.
I'm not saying all.
But the important thing is, what do they mean by a two-state solution? And what about two-thirds of Israeli Jews reject a Palestinian capital in East Jerusalem? And Poland, and about almost 50% of Israeli Jews reject the dismantling of any settlements whatsoever. I think there is a big gap between what many Israeli Jews mean when they say Palestinian state and what Palestinians mean, which is essentially the 67 lines.
Of course there's a gap. That's why they disagree. The settlements are 2% of the West Bank, right? Jerusalem is 2% of the 67 lines. The Palestinians could get 98% of where they live, maybe more, probably 100% of where they live, very close, and they could get 90% of the empty land. And Israel says, fine, that's a two-state solution. It cannot be that if you say you support a two-state solution, that you only support a two-state solution in the 67 lines. That's not a two-state solution. That's a capitulation to everything the Palestinians want. That means the Western Wall goes under Palestinian rule, even though the Western Wall has been under Jewish control or Jewish rule or in the Jewish quarter for thousands of years. So it strikes me that obviously, the Palestinians say two-state solution. They have a very different state in mind from the Israelis who say it's two-state solution. But we're talking about a really minor difference, maybe 10% of the land that's differed.
Abbas' UN speech was problematic in the fact that it didn't talk about the Jewish historical connection to the land, and I do think that Palestinian leaders need to be wrapped on the knuckles when they seem in some way to kind of ignore or discard or underemphasize the Jewish historical connection to the land of Israel. But to be fair to Abbas, right, who I think is better than Arafat, Olmert himself has said that Abbas was negotiating seriously in 2008. He said they were close, and he urged Netanyahu to continue those negotiations and try to make a deal. And we know that at In 2008, Abbas proposed a 1.9% land swap with Jewish control over all the Jewish neighborhoods of East Jerusalem, which of course would there leave them in control of the Kotel.
We don't. He hasn't put that in writing.
Gave their maps and proposals, very detailed ones, to Netanyahu's negotiators at least twice. The same things they had proposed to Olmert. Oh, it was
but
Netanyahu
not,
who never,
well, didn't make them
never
public.
Offered a map for what his vision of a Palestinian state is.
Then I say make them public because Israel has made its proposals public. I know proposals public under Camp David.
I praise Olmert. I think Olmert
and Barak too.
What was doing was great. I just wish he'd been able to stay in power longer. So I actually think that was pretty significant negotiating on the part of Abbas. And I would have continued to negotiate and wouldn't have even probably focused on a settlement freeze.
The heart of the argument I'm trying to make, and it's one that people don't talk about very often, is that the fight is over empty land. That most people say, all right, the 2% of Jews that are in the settlements, they get to stay in Israel. The 40% of the land that's controlled by the Arabs, they get to stay in the West Bank. That makes sense to me. We're fighting over the 58% of empty land. And obviously it has to be contiguous. Obviously A and B and C all have to be connected. That makes sense. But then you go inch by inch. My solution, if you want to hear it, is that
I say allow the Jewish areas to be controlled by Jews and the Arab areas to be controlled by Arabs. And then let's fight over the middle ground. And Israel's willing to give 90% of the empty land over to the Arabs. It would be a contiguous state. It would all connect. They'd be able to travel from one area to another. This is how these things are resolved. This is how they were resolved in Ireland. It's how they're resolved in India and Pakistan. Basically, where the Hindus live, that becomes India. Where the Muslims live, that becomes Pakistan. Where the Jews live, that becomes Israel. Where the Arabs live, that becomes Palestine. And the empty land, you negotiate over. And I think 91% is a pretty, of the empty land. I think that's a very, very generous offer from Israel to the Palestinians.
Palestinians could have had a state 12 years ago, they could have a state today if they're willing to
say, we'll accept 98% or 99%. They said, without 100%, we're walking away and we're going to cause violence and we're going to attack with bombs Jews in Israel. And that to me is saying that there's no negotiation at all.
But this idea that 91% isn't good enough and that perpetual war should continue because you only get 90% of what you want, it doesn't make sense to me.
I mean, Israel could certainly control the area where the Jews live. It's less than 2%. All these settlements that Abbas is complaining about and Obama's complaining about and people are going to the United Nations about, it's less than 2% of a very, very small area. It's probably less than the size of the District of Columbia. It's a tiny, tiny area. It's mostly connected to very close to the old line in Israel. And, of course, the Arabs only live in 40%. So Jews live in 2%. Arabs live in 40%.
The fundamental terms of the division, it seems to me, need to be thought about in terms of the parameters of British Mandatory Palestine. And as you know, even a Palestinian state on all of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is only 22% of British Mandatory Palestine.
Plus the 70% that's east of the Jordan River.
To its credit, I think we would both agree to its credit, in 1947, accepted a deal which would have left them with 55% of British Mandatory Palestine. Now we're saying, from the Israeli perspective, from the Jewish perspective, that a 78%, 22% split is not good enough.
Well, wait. You're not including
22%. It's actually, they have 70%, which is Jordan. Remember, every area east of the Jordan River is Palestine. It's now the country of Jordan. It was designed to be a Palestinian state. It was originally, under the League of Nations mandate, supposed to be part of the Jewish state. So please don't tell me they only have 22%.
80% Transjordan would be for the Arabs, and the western part, west of the Jordan River, would be for the Jews. So
yes, but
why can't we connect the Palestinian state to Jordan?
First of all, the Palestinians of the West Bank do not live in Jordan at this point. I think that the Palestinians, if that state is ever going to be remotely economically viable and genuinely contiguous, it needs that empty land. If it doesn't have it, or even if you include the settlement of Ariel inside Israel, I mean, look at a map and see, look at the northern Palestinian cities of Tulkarm and Qalqilia, and see how difficult it becomes to get from them to the rest of the West Bank if you have Ariel sticking 13 miles through the northern West Bank.
And see how difficult it is to get to Tel Aviv when Tukharm and Kalkia are 9 miles from the ocean. They're 9 miles from the sea. You complain that Ariel sticks 13 miles into the West Bank. What about the fact that Tukharm and Kalkia make Israel smaller than the District of Columbia in the area where the vast majority of its people live and its coastline where its industry is, right? These are the sacrifices you make. The Palestinians may come all the way of 40, 50, 60 miles west until they're within 9 miles of the ocean and they can cut Israel in two in a minute. And yes, it is Ariel may go 13 miles in the West Bank. So you have to draw the lines carefully to include them all. It can be done. But you only seem to mention the Palestinian problems and not the Israeli problems. And I'd like you to be more fair to both sides.
There are enormous problems of contiguity, even if you only try to keep 8 or 9% of the West Bank, let alone if you start dividing up the empty land as well. That's not going to lead to the contiguous Palestinian state that you want, and it's going to be a recipe for war.
Well, I don't know why it wouldn't lead to contiguous Palestinian state. Every
why
offer
not?
I've seen Israel give...
Shlomo Ben-Ami said, the former Israeli foreign minister, says that Ariel makes Palestinian contiguity very difficult.
Well, you say we all know from gerrymandering maps in Congress that contiguousness is something that can be done through a very thin line.
But there's a difference, because when you drive from one congressional district to another with those crazy lines, you don't have to pass through another state.
No, but
right?
It
becomes much more difficult when you try to create a state which looks like one of those bizarre
gerrymandered. It would be very easy to draw to have a bridge. I mean, Ehud Barak even talked about having, which I thought was amazing, a 25, 30-mile bridge from Gaza to the West Bank that would overhang Israel, which belongs to Israel. There are ways this can be done. If you look at maps of Belgium and the Netherlands, you will see there's exclaves and enclaves and all kinds of things there. I don't know anyone that seriously argues.
The value that Israel is getting from paying people, essentially subsidizing them to move from what I call democratic Israel to Ariel. I mean, what's the benefit? We know the costs for the Palestinians, right?
Which is what are the costs for the Palestinians?
Best, all kinds of very weird workaround solutions in order for them to get from one Palestinian to the other. What are we getting from the fact that we subsidized all these poor Russians to move to Ariel?
Well, I don't support the subsidies, but it's interesting you talk about the Russians. I know you know this, but you're not conveying it, that the Arab Jewish population, which is of course the majority of Israel, and it never bears not repeating. The majority of Israeli Jews come from Arab countries. They are Arab Jews.
The Russian immigration.
No, they still do.
40%. No, I think you're wrong, but we can disagree about that.
Yeah, the Russians took them down from 60% to 55%. But the interesting thing is, they are the ones who most are likely to support the right wing parties, the Likud parties, Shas, and other parties that take a much harsher line against the Arabs, because they are the ones who are the refugees from Arab countries. They are the ones who lived in.
I don't mean to cut you off.
I was just going to say, but like, for example, more than 100,000 Jews of Iraq were kicked out of Iraq. There were Arabs that left the new state of Israel. There were Jews that left the Arab countries.
At the time of Israel's founding, about 500,000, 600,000 Palestinians, Arabs, left the new state of Israel. And Palestinian Jews came in. Right? Because Palestine doesn't mean anything in this context. They're Arabs, all right? They're Arab lands. And Arabs left the new Jewish state, and Jews left the old Arab states. And what's interesting is there was a greater number of Jews kicked out of Arab countries than Arabs that left the new state of Israel. 800,000 Jews were forced to leave Egypt and Libya and Tunisia and Algeria and Iraq and Syria and all throughout the Arab world, where they had lived for thousands of years and had no place to go. And they found a home in Israel. And a smaller number of Arabs leaving the Jewish state were refused citizenship by the various Arab countries. And in India and Pakistan, there were 26 million people who switched sides. Hindus who did not want to live in Muslim Pakistan, and Muslims who did not want to live in Hindu India. 26 million people switched sides.
I think your narrative about the Mizrahim, of whom I am one, on my mother's side, of why the Mizrahim lean right in Israel, they were subject to intense discrimination by the Ashkenazi European elite.
The majority of Israel, of course, the majority of the Jews in Israel are from the Middle East. They're not from Europe. But Peter likes to talk about the Russian Jews. as if there's something wrong with Israel taking in the Russian Jews, who, let's face it, had no place to go. Right? They're persecuted in Russia, and no other country would take them in. It's a lot like the Jews of the Holocaust were persecuted and had no other country to take them in. But Jews, Israel takes in Jews wherever they live. Unfortunately, Arab countries won't do the same. They refuse to take in Arabs. And even though in other population swaps throughout the history of humanity, India and Pakistan being the classic example, but there are many, many others. I mean, you could talk about the fact that the whole eastern third of Germany is now part of Poland. And millions of Germans went west because the Germans fought an aggressive war in World War II and lost it, and they lost territory. And the Germans who didn't want to live in Poland moved west. So when the Arabs kicked out the Jews, when Russia kicks out the Jews have a place to go. It's Israel. But the Arabs who are in the West Bank apparently don't want to go. They don't have to go anywhere. But they don't even want to join with their fellow Arabs in Jordan, which is the eastern part of Palestine. Right? Jordan is the 80% of Palestine that was supposed to be the Arab state way back in 1922. That's why when they call themselves Palestinians, you see what they're doing? They're trying to say, we are not Arabs. We are not, Jordan is eastern Palestine. We're not Jordanians. They give themselves a different name purposely to try to argue they should have more territory. I can give you an historic example that was very similar to this. In the Sudetenland, in Czechoslovakia, in 1938, German-speaking Czechs said, we don't want to be part of Czechoslovakia. We are a separate people. We're not Germans. We are Sudetens, because we live in the Sudetenland, and we need our own state. And they convinced the world to allow Hitler to create this independent state, the Sudetenland, which very simply after Hitler not only marched in the Sudetenland, he marched in and took over all of Czechoslovakia because the Sudetenland included areas that were easier to defend. The heart of what I'm saying is the Arabs deserve a state. They have 23. If they want another one, I'm okay with that. The Jews deserve at least one state. I don't believe in the destruction of the state of Israel. But I also don't believe that the empty land necessarily belongs to anybody. It was Ottoman territory. It was under Turkey. But Turkey says they don't own it anymore. They lost it in World War I. Then the British owned it. But then they left in 1948 and said, you fight over Jews and Arabs. Then Jordan came in, invaded the West Bank illegally. But now Jordan says they don't own the land. There's only one country on earth that claims to own the land, and that's Israel.
I'm arguing it is disputed territory, not occupied territory.
See, to me, it doesn't to me fundamentally matter. The issue is not for me that it's Palestinian, it's quote-unquote Palestinian land.
The argument that Europeans make more often than Americans in the United
States. That's not my view.
The
issue is, look, you can call them Israelis, which to me is a much more frightening prospect because it would imperil Israel as a Jewish state. And the other is to create a Palestinian state in which I believe Jews have absolutely every right to live as equal citizens, so they will not be under IDF protection, and that to me is the better answer.
So they won't be under IDF, the Israeli Defense Force protection. And yet you know that whenever Jews have lived without protection, they've been completely persecuted. That is not the case, as you know, with the Arabs in Israel, who not only serve in the Knesset, in the parliament, but also serve in labor unions, also serve in all kinds of high positions. I tell you, Peter, I know you have to go, and I want to thank you for the interview. I want to thank you for spending time with me right here on We Act Radio. The heart of what I'm saying, and I think the heart of what you're saying, is we both agree in a two-state solution. We both agree that there should be one more Arab state in the area. They can call themselves Palestine, alongside the Jewish state of Israel. You say Israel is non-democratic because the Palestinians refuse to accept the offers given to them by Israel to incorporate all the lands where the Arabs live, plus 90% of the empty land, because you think they deserve 100% or 98%, and I think that 91% is pretty generous. But that tiny little difference, that 7% of empty land, to me, is something that good, well-meaning people can disagree on. It's not enough to attack all of the West Bank as non-democratic because of a disagreement over 7% of land. But I want to thank you for coming on the show. I appreciate it very much. This is Mark Levine. This is The Inside Scoop. This is We Act Radio. And I think I've shown that I can talk about whether it's Syria or Israel. The Middle East matters. It's complex. But sometimes it's all just a matter of allowing people the democratic right to choose their own destiny. And that doesn't mean necessarily control of every empty land in the world, but my belief is really quite simple. Where people live, they should be able to control that area most of the time. And if you have a dictatorship as exists throughout the Arab world, in Syria, in, I mean, Egypt was just overturned, Libya was just overturned, you've also, Tunisia's just overturned, Algeria has a dictatorship, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and yes, Hamas is a dictatorship, Hezbollah is a dictatorship, the Palestinian Authority is a dictatorship. That these are not Israel's fault. And one of the reasons I so support the Arab Spring is I support the fact that Arabs are now taking their own democracy into their own hands, simply trying to control their own countries, control their own destiny, and that's certainly something I support. This is Mark Levine. I hope you enjoyed the entire show. We'll be back, of course, next Sunday on We Act Radio. We'll be with Nancy from 11 to 1, and then by myself from 1 to 3. Listen, every Sunday, 14:80 a.m. on We Act Radio. You can follow me on Twitter at Mark Levine Talk. You can also go to my Facebook fan page, the Mark Levine fan page. Please check me out. Go to my website, marklevinetalk.com, for this show or any of the shows that you've heard. This is Mark Levine signing off.
You're listening to WPWC, We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.